You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Foreign Affairs Magazine invites you to join our editors as they talk to influential thinkers and policymakers about the forces shaping the world. The Foreign Affairs Interview, a bi-weekly podcast, gives you a chance to hear directly from our authors as they explain the history behind today's geopolitics and how current events could shape our future. Follow the Foreign Affairs Interview wherever you listen to podcasts.
In 2011, Joe Biden met Xi Jinping for the first time in China. They were both vice presidents. And the idea was that they would just get to know each other. They went for walks, had meals. They played basketball together. There's a video of this. Xi stands grinning on the sidelines while Biden makes a basket to big applause. According to Biden, it was the start of him and Xi Jinping really connecting. But how well can anyone really know the elusive Xi Jinping? I'm Jane Perlez, and this is Face Off, a podcast exploring the high-stakes U.S.-China relationship. On today's episode, we'll examine how the leaders of these two world powers operate with each other. Plus, I'll chat with China historian Rana Mitter to get his perspective on how Biden and Xi do or don't get along. Two years after that first meeting between Biden and Xi, I was in Beijing on a cold December afternoon, waiting in the press club bar at the St. Regis Hotel. Joe Biden had invited a group of American reporters to hear about his latest meeting with the now President Xi.
I know the man. I know his modus operandi. We have disagreements. He has a different view than I have on a lot of things, but he's been straight. I don't mean that it's good, bad, or indifferent. It's just been straight.
But how straight has Xi Jinping really been? And what difference does knowing each other make when push comes to shove?
I'm personally skeptical about how deeply Biden would know Xi through even hours and hours of personal meetings.
Min-Chin Pei is a political scientist at Claremont McKenna College. He was born in China and came to the United States to study. He's written extensively on the relationship between the U.S. and China, most recently in a great new book, The Sentinel State. I started our conversation by asking about that first fateful meeting between Xi Jinping and Biden in 2011.
Chinese leaders are pretty good at wasting these long hours without showing what they really think. In fact, the Chinese Communist Party has very strict rules about talking to foreigners, even if you are a very senior leader. So Biden probably overestimated the amount of information he was able to extract from those hours spent with Xi Jinping.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. The next time that Biden and Xi Jinping met was in 2012 in Washington. It was Valentine's Day, February 14th, and there was this big lunch at the State Department hosted by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Vice President Biden. I was there because I was about to go off and be correspondent to China. I have to say, at a front row seat, so I got a full view. And that room was just full of anybody who was anybody about China and the United States. And they were all smiles. Everyone thought that Xi Jinping was going to be a reformer and that relations would grow between the US and China. They would grow much warmer. Business would continue. Everything would be fine. How could they get him so wrong?
Well, I don't blame them. I think everybody got Xi wrong. Only a very small number of people, probably in China, got him right.
Who would they have been?
I was skeptical. I never, if you look at my own public record, I never claimed and saw Xi was going to be a reformer. I think it's wishful thinking. When they look at the second half of the Hu Jintao era, reform was stagnating, problems were building up. They saw China needed reform, and they looked around and saw this man in waiting and said, ah, that's our reformer. Pure wishful thinking. They had absolutely no evidence. Because when you look at Xi Jinping, he has a very illustrious resume, but he does not have an illustrious record. He had not done anything before he became the party chief to show he's either reformer or conservative. In other words, he was a supremely good politician.
So when did he first reveal his colors? When did he first show that he was determined to make China a peer competitor with the United States and to develop China as quickly as possible?
You really need to look at his foreign policy speeches. And I've been working on a book. I did not find Xi's foreign policy speeches. I'm sure he said a lot, but what he said must be still viewed as too sensitive, potentially too damaging, revealing his intentions and strategy. But what we know about his domestic intention was very clear. End of 2012, after he became the party chief, he went to Guangdong and delivered probably off-the-cuff remarks in which he said, what happened to the Soviet Union we need to be aware of. The party became too soft, did not protect its ideology overnight. A party of tens of millions of people just disintegrated.
Yes, I think he said this very telling phrase. They were not man enough.
No man enough. But what's really interesting in the in my research of domestic policy is that Xi delivered in January 2013 what I would say his political manifesto at the Central Party School to new Central Committee members and new provincial officials. What's interesting is that the speech had two versions. The Communist Party released part of the speech soon after, but did not release the whole text until 2019. So when you compare the initial excerpts with the full text, you should be surprised because she was very clear about what he was going to do internally. He was going to walk back reform, control ideology. He was not going to give up socialism. The title of the speech is On Several Questions About Socialism with Chinese Characteristics.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
That speech is very revealing about his core beliefs. And I suspect at that time, 2013, they did not want to release that speech because that would shock people.
Sort of a conformist communist, if you like.
Yes, this is very orthodox.
When he came to California in the summer of 2013, this is just a few months after he was anointed president, he met with President Obama at Sunnylands, a big California estate. It was supposed to be an informal gathering of Obama and Xi and their aides. There was one funny incident, I was told, at the cocktail hour. Obama said to Xi, and what would you like to drink? And Xi very politely and diplomatically said, well, whatever you're having. And the waiter came up with a big fat martini for Xi Jinping.
Not his kind of drink. He likes no. red wine.
So I wasn't told the follow-up as to whether he put it back on the tray, took a sip or and grimaced or what, but maybe that was a harbinger of things not going so well there. There was something lacking in the chemistry.
That meeting didn't go well. I think that meeting was suggested by the U.S. There's like, get to know you. A lot of things were off. I think Xi Jinping proposed the idea of new type of great power relations, which the U.S. did not embrace. So that was a downer for him. And I think by that time, probably Xi already was convinced that the U.S. was a declining power. He did not to be as solicitous as his predecessors. In fact, a year later, the Belt and Road Initiative was rolled out. And then 2014, China began to build artificial islands in the South China Sea, a very aggressive move.
Yeah, so this was a big, big assertion of power by
yes,
Xi Jinping
absolutely.
On neighboring waters. And by that time, Xi was beginning to meet with his neighbor, Putin.
Oh, absolutely.
By now, they've met 40 times. I haven't counted the number of times Xi and Biden have met, but Xi has met many more times with Putin, of course. And it's so much more intimate. They drape medals around each other's neck. Xi told Putin when he left Moscow in 2023 that they'd be doing, quote, great things together that would change the world. Which sounded pretty ominous. How does the chemistry between Putin and Xi work in the way that it doesn't work between Biden and Xi Jinping, despite what Biden might say?
Most probably ideological. Both Putin and Xi have very negative feelings about liberal democracy. They saw liberal democracy as an ideological threat to their respective political systems. And the other part would be geopolitical interests being aligned between the two countries. Both Russia and China resent American dominance. They believe the U.S. is out to get them, and they don't believe the U.S. belongs, in the case of Russia, in Europe, in the case of China, East Asia. So there are a lot of things that they will have very similar views on, and that would bring them together. I think in terms of socialization experience, very different, because Putin rose from the very bottom, probably a very diligent, pretty good student, and Xi Jinping was this princeling who was privileged.
You know, during the Trump years, let's move on to the Trump years, it was a pretty rough time for U.S.-China relations. What do you think Xi made of Trump?
He got one thing about Trump right, and he got many things about Trump wrong. One thing he got Trump right is that Trump is a very vain, narcissistic man, so he would treat him like an emperor. That's why Trump got the only so-called stay visit plus treatment in China. The Forbidden City was open for Trump alone, had tea there. Trump's ego was stroked really well.
And Trump was shown the golden treasures of the Forbidden City Museum.
Trump was treated like emperor. But what it did not know about Trump is that Trump never returns favors. So Trump takes everything for granted. So that stay visit plus, whatever they call it, the extraordinary show of respect, did not register with Trump that China expects things in return. Trump never thought he owed China anything. The visit took place in November 2017. 3 months later, Trump began the trade war. Xi Jinping also got Trump wrong in one sense. That Trump would escalate. All Trump cared for is his strongman image. The problem with Xi is that Trump had ample ammunition to escalate with, and China had limited ammunition. The U.S. bought a lot more from China than the other way around. So in the end, Xi had to give. It was a very humiliating experience for Xi.
Really? So do you think he was relieved when Biden came back into the White House and he didn't have to deal with this egomaniac Donald Trump?
I think he was initially relieved. But then I think the first meeting in Alaska, March 2021, didn't go well.
Biden wasn't there. It was Biden's aides who made a mess of that.
Both sides made mistakes, but I think they misread the U.S. After Trump left, the damage was done. The foundations of bilateral relations were devastated. It was very difficult to put the Humpty Dumpty together.
Biden, in public, has been quite unkind towards Xi Jinping. He's shown quite a bit of public disdain for Xi.
He called him a thug, a dictator, right?
I spent more time with Xi Jinping than any world leader had by the time we left office. This is a guy who doesn't have a Democratic with a small D bone in his body. This is a guy who is a thug.
And he told a television interviewer, I don't know any world leader who would want to trade places with Xi Jinping. Yeah. His circumstances are enormously complicated. And then in front of the press, Biden just said flat out, he's a dictator.
Yeah.
How would Xi have reacted to that?
What's interesting, I think Xi learned his lesson. Xi's diplomatic skills have vastly improved.
Really? How so?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. If you look at his recent behavior, the Chinese foreign policy today is a very different foreign policy. They've learned to avoid wolf warrior rhetoric. For one thing.
Wolf warrior rhetoric means?
Very aggressive, in your face. If you call me a name, I'll call you two names. I'm sure she cannot be very happy with what Biden said about him in public. But he would say, well, he's a politician. He'll dismiss that. He's not going to allow a personal snub to affect his strategic calculation. This change probably occurred preceding the November San Francisco meeting. After the Trump trade war and this collapse of relations with the U.S., in the last few months of the Trump administration, the real collapse, the free fall happened after the COVID pandemic. And Biden put in place a very comprehensive containment strategy. Biden rallied allies. So she believed that China had to play the long game. That is, we are not going to confront you from a position of weakness. There are other countries or regimes around that would give U.S. headaches all the time. Russia being one, Iran another, Hamas, Houthis. So it would get its internal house in order. I think most importantly, it wants to develop its indigenous technological capabilities. It wants to become much less reliant on the U.S. market. So it wants to reduce U.S. leverage. So in the short to medium term, the Chinese response, strategic response, is to reduce such leverage. So we're talking decoupling from both sides. So once the countries are decoupled, the U.S. will have no leverage over China, and the China will have a lot more freedom of action. In the meantime, it's just foolish to pick a fight when other countries are doing the fighting for you.
Interesting. You know, it's also interesting to think about how Xi Jinping thinks about the United States. So, for example, Chinese propaganda makes a big deal out of Xi Jinping having visited Iowa in the 1980s as a young Communist Party official. And his ties to the United States continued when his daughter attended Harvard, although Xi never refers to that, and there's never any reference in the Chinese press to his daughter having attended Harvard. What's your assessment of what Xi really thinks about the United States?
I think his direct personal experience with the U.S. is very limited. But Xi is not out of touch with reality. He understands American power. So I think it fluctuates. Today probably has a lot more respect or a much more realistic appreciation of American power.
You say that because his economy is going through a bad phase and the United States economy is doing relatively okay. Why do you say that?
This is partly the issue. The rise of China has stumbled. But also, he looked at the exercise of American power. More and more countries have shown that they are standing with the U.S. The U.S. export controls really hurt. And geopolitical uncertainty or tensions with the U.S. have cast such a dark shadow over investments into China. If he thought the East is rising and the West is declining, today I don't think he's going to say the same thing again.
Well, he wouldn't say it if he was talking honestly, perhaps.
Again, I'm going through his speeches. What he says is much more subtle, is that the world is experiencing massive changes unseen in 100 years. So you can read whatever you want to read into this expression.
It's like his smile. He smiles all the time. Well, yeah, a lot of the time. What do you read into the smile when he's with Biden or when he's with Americans?
He's a politician, so he has to sort of put on a show all politicians are good at. That is, even if you meet with people you don't like, you smile, you call them your friends. So I think he's pretty good at that.
So what do you think may have gone through his mind in San Francisco when he and Biden met in 2023? Relations were going very badly. They had a four-hour meeting and some lunch, and they walked around, and all the reports afterwards said, well, things are a bit better now. It's not going to go to the edge of the cliff right now. And apparently Biden told Xi Jinping in those 4 hours, oh, by the way, you'll be meeting with me in 5 years. I'm going to beat Donald Trump in the election in 2024. How do you think Xi would have reacted to that?
She probably would say, good luck. I think right now, maybe you can quote Winston Churchill, joy is better than war, right? Talking serves Chinese interests and clearly serves Biden's interest. Let's just face it, the two countries are in a structural conflict. The rivalry, whatever you call it, Cold War, is going to last decades. And these meetings help. I think we need to be very worried if, should Trump win, things become so bad they don't talk to each other.
Yes, I was going to ask you, how do you think Xi Jinping looks at the potential of another 4 years of Trump? Do you think he'd prefer to have Biden in the White House, or would he prefer to have Trump in the White House?
I joke that pick your poison. With Biden in the House, they can maintain a level of certainty, even though tensions will remain high. They know that Biden is a solid foreign policy hand. He's not going to do crazy things. But at the same time, Biden is very good at building a solid structure of containment. Allies, domestic competition policy, industrial policy, export controls. So over time, China's space will be further constricted.
But don't you think Trump will do that in spades?
No, no, no. Trump will do everything at once at the beginning because the Republican Party's base is very anti-China, much more anti-China than the Democratic Party base. And I actually worry a lot about Trump's potential national security team because they can be a lot more hawkish. If you think the Biden team is hawkish, you ain't seen anything yet. And they were saying, well, China will threaten Taiwan with military exercises. Biden will, of course, be very restrained, but not Trump's people. Let's just send the 7th Fleet, let the aircraft carriers. So you could have very quickly a Cuban Missile Crisis type situation.
Wow, Minxin, you paint a very grim picture, which reminds me of one very famous great power meeting back in the early 60s, Khrushchev and JFK. They met in Vienna.
Vienna, yeah.
Very early on in JFK's presidency. Khrushchev, during that meeting, just ripped into JFK. Yeah. And JFK came out absolutely ashen-faced and told the New York Times famous columnist at the time, James Reston, immediately afterwards, he savaged me. You know, JFK was just humiliated. The history books have put it down in part to bad briefing by the CIA. CIA told JFK this, you know, when his left temple begins to throb, you know he's mad. But that wasn't very useful. They didn't tell JFK. Khrushchev was likely to go on and on and on about the virtues of Marxism and Leninism how communism was the win in the world. And so there were a lot of hard feelings. How do you think the CIA and others brief Biden before he goes to see Xi Jinping? And anyway, does he listen?
And I will be very skeptical about the reliability of their profiling. It would be interesting. People like us could write a briefing, and then the CIA could write a briefing, and then we'll see which briefing is much more accurate. And I bet our briefing will be better.
You think so?
Oh, yeah. I have absolutely no doubt. Because CIA does not have that kind of intelligence work in China anymore, for one thing.
They don't have people on the ground.
Yeah, because their network has been rolled up around 2010. Yeah, so they don't really have that much. And of course, they can do eavesdropping and so forth, but Xi Jinping does not use mobile phones. So open source research can do just as good a job as the much wanted CIA can.
Minxin Pei, you know more than any of us, so thank you very much for sharing your deep knowledge and writing so many valuable books that help us understand China.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Jay.
Same here. Minxin Pei is a political scientist and a brilliant thinker based at Claremont McKenna College. His new book is The Sentinel State, Surveillance and the Survival of Dictatorship in China. Up next, Rana Mitta joins me. We'll be back in a moment. I invite you to listen to Bonnie Lin's CSIS China Power podcast. It's the leading podcast from CSIS in Washington, D.C. She brings together the big experts on China and international politics to dissect critical issues around China's emergence as a global power. Recent topics on her podcast include China's lessons from the Ukraine conflict, gender dynamics in China, China's military reforms, and its build-up of its nuclear forces. Her podcast allows listeners to get critical insights into the challenges and opportunities presented by China's growing power. I'm back with China historian Rana Mitta. Rana, I have to ask you, do you think Xi Jinping really looks at the political divisions in the U.S. and thinks, Biden's support among Americans is not strong. In fact, it's pretty weak. Therefore, I'm going to take advantage of that.
I think that Xi Jinping actually, from what we know, and it's obviously very opaque in many ways about his mindset, thinks more broadly that the democracies of the West and the United States will be included are in bad shape. I suspect there's a part of him that maybe thinks that actually who becomes president isn't necessarily that big a deal in terms of the overall trajectory of democracy. That doesn't mean that he doesn't care whether President Biden's reelected or President Trump comes back, but he, I do think, believes that the wider system is fragile and has a real capacity to essentially either slowly fall apart or collapse. We should also note that, from what we know, he's pretty influenced by one of the top guys on the Politburo Standing Committee, Wang Huning. Propaganda chief, of course, you might say, for the entire party. And a man who, about 30 years ago, slightly more than that actually, wrote a book called America versus America. Wang Huning was arguing that the United States contained inherent contradictions that eventually would, you know, tear it apart. And I think that conviction has not been reduced or removed by anything that the Chinese feel that they've observed in the last, you know, 10 years, 20 years. I think that that book title, you know, even though it's some decades old now, tells you a lot about the way they think about it.
You know, we started this episode asking whether the length of time that Xi and Biden have known each other will make a difference when push comes to shove. Can a personal relationship between two leaders make a difference? What does history tell us, and what does your knowledge of China tell you about this particular situation?
It can make a difference, but in this case, I think that Xi Jinping probably has it right in that they have met each other many, many times, but I'm not sure that constitutes a relationship in terms of them understanding each other, having a sense of empathy. I mean, language, as Xi Jinping said, is part of that. That isn't necessarily an absolute barrier. I'm sure you'll remember, Jane, that back in the late Cold War, when Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, you know, took their walk in the woods, they didn't speak each other's languages, and so they did have interpreters. But even so, there did seem to be a meeting of minds there, and we all know that some part of the ending of the Cold War came from those encounters. I don't have a sense that the relationship between Biden and Xi is in that sort of category at all. I'd bring back the example, actually, the contrast between Xi and Putin. Now, again, it's so difficult with two such secretive leaders to have a really intimate portrait of any kind of top-level relationship. But the information that analysts seem to have suggests that Xi and Putin do talk to each other quite a bit and somehow do seem to have a bit of a mind meld. You know, there is a genuine sort of empathy between them. And that's not always the case with Russian and Chinese leaders, even communists. You know, Mao Zedong and Khrushchev famously got on really, really badly. So it's not inevitable, but it does seem to be the case here. And that kind of ability to sort of get across cultural barriers just doesn't seem to be there, I think, in the case of Xi and Biden. So they've known each other, or at least have met each other on many occasions, known each other for a long time. But I think I'd hesitate to call it a long-term relationship.
Not even a bromance, of course, not at all. What would you call it?
I'd call it, you know, a series of encounters. I mean, I think that the value, and I think it is there, of them having at least met each other on various occasions, is a sense that they can do pragmatic business. There's probably never going to be any kind of joint agenda between them, but the idea that maybe there would be an opportunity to, say, do something very pragmatic, like set up a hotline between the two militaries. That kind of quite transactional but useful set of encounters. If that counts as a relationship, then okay, I think that that is there, but I don't think it goes beyond that.
I'm wondering if they even have respect for each other.
I don't know, but there's an interesting contrast perhaps there again. If you think about President Biden's predecessor, President Trump, early on in his presidency, before he started really pushing back against China on trade, he gave Xi Jinping a lot of praise. Donald Trump said he's the president of China, but, you know, they call him the king of China because he has this, you know, huge amount of power. And there is that wonderful, rather baroque moment that Trump spoke of, where he said that he was hosting Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago, and that he gave him the biggest, most beautiful piece of chocolate cake he'd had, and then told him, we're about to start bombing Syria. And, you know, your question was about respect. And although there's something, as I say, slightly sort of, you know, baroque, that's the best adjective I can think of, about that moment at Mar-a-Lago, and I'd love to know what Xi Jinping made of it, think about the elements. You know, on the one hand, Trump is complimenting Xi in this. You know, he's wanted to give him a good time, make him feel comfortable, hence the chocolate cake. But then off the back of that, you know, he's basically talking to a major leader of another country and saying, by the way, we, the United States, have just launched a geopolitically very significant action, this bombing of Syria, you know, tonight while you're here. You know, that's not something you just do to anyone. So in a strange way, a moment where Donald Trump was the one who was actually giving a certain amount of respect to Xi might be a better way to think about it. I can't imagine Joe Biden inviting, you know, Xi to come and have a seat, come and maybe, you know, have a couple of Cokes or slush puppies or whatever they would have together, and then say, you know, by the way, this is about what we're going to do in Iran.
Probably not. Rana, as always, it's great to discuss things with you. Thank you for all your insights.
Thank you, Jane. A pleasure, and looking forward to the next episode.
Me too. Next time on Face Off, we speak with a real-life spy.
And everywhere you would go in China, there were little old ladies who would register your presence. If you wanted to make a phone call, the phone would be kept in a padlocked box. You would give the number to an elderly lady who would dial the number for you.
How and why are the US and China spying on one another? Then and now. Thanks so much for listening. If you like what you hear, please recommend Face Off to a friend. This project is made possible by the generous support of the Carnegie Corporation. Face Off is produced and reported by me, Jane Perlez. Special guest, Rana Mitter. Executive producer, Mia Lobel. Senior producer, Nina Pozuki. Sound design and mixing by John Myers and Alex Lewis of Rohome Productions. Original score by Alex Lewis. Show art by Good Tape Studio. Research by Luz Ding. Special thanks to Paul Bogards and Maggie Taylor. Special thanks also to the Belfer Center at the Harvard Kennedy School for their support.
Rohome Productions.
Foreign Affairs magazine invites you to join our editors as they talk to influential thinkers and policymakers about the forces shaping the world. The Foreign Affairs Interview, a bi-weekly podcast, gives you a chance to hear directly from our authors as they explain the history behind today's geopolitics and how current events could shape our future. Follow the Foreign Affairs Interview wherever you listen to podcasts.